We're going to ask, and the bailiff has been instructed to add 3 additional minutes for each side to this next case to 18 minutes, okay? I think that the students will find this case very interesting, and I think because both sides were given notice yesterday that we wanted them to address an additional case, that it makes sense to add some time to this case. So we are now at the case of People versus Lamb. I see that counsel already, and the same rules apply, and you'll get 5 minutes when the amber light will go on, and let me know if you want to save some time for rebuttal. With that, we'll proceed.
Good morning. I'm Allison Ruttenberg for Mr. Lamb.
Please be sure to speak up, okay, because they have a hard time with the acoustics.
Am I being heard okay now?
Can you hear her okay? Yeah, be closer to the mic.
Yeah. Well, I'm having... Okay, is that a little bit better? Apparently that mic's not very sensitive.
It's a little bit better.
Okay.
You're going to have to talk loudly and then...
It's a little difficult here. This podium is smaller than in the normal courtroom. And I'm trying to balance my laptop here. Okay, I'm Allison Ruttenberg, appellant's counsel. My attorney registration number is 17497. I was appointed by the alternate defense counsel in this case. I understand that the people want us to address People versus Ortega on the first issue I raised in my opening brief. Before we do that, however, I would like to briefly address the third issue regarding shackling. I did read the other division's opinion in the co-defendant's case, People versus Hong, which came out, I believe, on February 16th. And that panel refused to address the merits of that case. I believe my co-counsel briefed the issue almost identically based on the same evidence that was in the record, since both Mr. Hong and Mr. Lamb were tried at the same trial and had the same pretrial proceedings. The panel in that case refused to reach the merits, stating that there was nothing in the record that the jury members actually saw the shackles, therefore there was no need for them to address the issue. I would respectfully disagree and request that this panel do address the merits of that issue, that there was evidence in the record that the shackles were audible as well as visible to the jury, and that it was actually the court's clerk that made that record after the sheriff's deputies initially denied that the shackling was visible.
And where in the record would we find that?
I can give you the exact site of when the clerk spoke up. Hang on just a second. Okay, that's volume 10 at 45, line 21 through page 46, line 3. And if there's no case out there that says that once the defendant raises the objection that the shackles are either visibly or audible, that then the jury has to be polled to see whether the jury members actually noticed or not, that it's sufficient that a record is made that the shackles are visible or audible in the courtroom themselves. I respectfully submit that your colleague's opinion now puts defense counsel in the position of necessarily having to file a Rule 35C motion after this appeal and claiming that it was ineffective for trial defense counsel to then either poll a jury after the trial or make a record in the courtroom asking the jury members whether they could see the shackles, and thereby necessarily highlighting an issue and kind of calling attention, to this unconstitutional practice. And there is no case law that would require that.
Okay.
Now, regarding the first issue, the airport stop, that issue, of course, was not present in the co-defendant's case because the co-defendant was not arrested at the airport. My client was arrested at the airport with Mr. Slatner, and Mr. Slatner participated in some of the pretrial proceedings and then pled guilty. So there is no appeal on this issue regarding any other co-defendant. I respectfully submit that People v. Ortega is so different on the facts that it's not even relevant to this case. In that case, the Colorado Supreme Court did find that the search of Ms. Ortega's luggage was constitutionally permissible, and therefore it was error for the trial court to suppress the contents and the fruits of the poisonous tree of the search of her luggage. But that search was so different from the facts in this case. This case is actually more like the Supreme Court case in Place, and in Place, the United States Supreme Court did find that search was unreasonable and unconstitutional. So if I could just outline all the differences between Ms. Ortega's case in this case. First of all, in the Ortega case, there was a legitimate government interest because initially the policeman and the drug dogs identified cause to believe that this luggage was containing drugs based on the smell kind of emanating from the luggage and various other items that they noticed that indicated to them as trained narcotics officers that it was likely to assume or to be suspicious that there was a reasonable suspicion that luggage contained drugs. Here, the only thing that was visible in plain view was cash. And there is no case that holds that cash is per se contraband. In fact, counsel, I cited to many cases in my opening brief. These are all federal cases.
Counsel, let me just follow up on what you said a minute ago. When he entered airport security, didn't he consent to a thorough search of his bag?
He of course consented to a search. And all that was visible initially was the cash. Based on the cash alone, that
what difference
cash
does it make
was
what
not,
was excuse me. What difference does it make what was visible? Because they were in weren't they entitled under Heimel to do a complete search of the bag?
They were only entitled to search him to the extent necessary to determine whether he presented a threat to airport security. And at the time that TSA identified him for further questioning and further searching, all they saw was the cash. And every single one of those law enforcement officials admitted that not only is carrying cash not contraband, it is also not, doesn't raise any security issues.
I understand, but they could have done, notwithstanding that all they initially saw was cash, the airport security people or Officer Rowe, when she was called over at about 11 o'clock, could have searched the entire bag to look for weapons or other dangerous objects, couldn't they?
But she didn't do it, and the bag didn't contain any weapons or dangerous objects. So,
but had they done such a search, they might have they would have discovered the masks and the jewelry, right?
Well, and again, we're kind of putting the cart before the horse. Our position is, and I briefed this very carefully, you have to take this step by step. And if at the initial screening, all she's detaining him for is because he has cash in his bag, and because the DEA agent now says, I would like to talk to this guy because he thinks maybe he's a drug courier, that is not constitutional. And
so we have about $20,000 in cash that's bound by rubber bands. And I think there was testimony that that there's concern within the DEA area that Denver is becoming a drug courier, a capital. Does that combination give them sufficiency for pause for a detention?
It might give them sufficient pause for detention to investigate further, but not for 90 minutes.
Was it 90 minutes or was it 30 minutes?
No, but the entire detention was 90 minutes. When you look at it from start to finish. He was not allowed to proceed to the gate until 90 minutes after he was originally detained.
At 11:30, he was given back his bag and his ID, is that correct?
He was never given his ID back until he was given his boarding pass, and that was an entire 90 minutes after the initial detention. And these are all other factual details that really distinguish this case from Ortega. Ms. Ortega's travel was never interrupted the way Mr. Lamb's was. She wasn't caused to miss her bus the way Mr. Lamb was caused to miss her plane. In fact, this detention of Mr. Lamb was designed to to guarantee almost that he missed his plane. Ms. Ortega's travel documents and her identification were not confiscated.
Okay, but Mr. the trial court found there was no bad faith in this, and we're bound by that historical finding, aren't we?
Well, whether or not there was bad faith or not is really not the issue. I mean, the issue is that he was, in fact, not free to go because he couldn't go because he neither had a boarding pass nor his identification. He missed his flight, unlike Ms. Ortega, so his travel was interrupted, and he was detained for 90 minutes, which the United States Supreme Court says was unreasonable under those circumstances in place.
But I thought we had a sort of a two-prong process here, that the second part involved the rebooking, but the first part involved a selectee line, and that the testimony was that took approximately 30 to 35 minutes, and then he was told that he could leave if he wanted to, or he could stay in the general area, but he decided to wait to be rebooked, and that's when the additional time factored in.
Well, I respectfully submit that the way that the facts are edited by the government is a little bit disingenuous, because he still wasn't given his ID back until after he was rebooked, number one. So he couldn't really leave until he had his boarding pass. He had no place to go until he was given his ID back. And
was he asked if he wanted to be rebooked, or did they just say, we're doing it for you?
He specifically asked to leave and was denied permission. When
officer, was 5 minutes before the flight? Is that what you're saying? When was that?
Before, after he was questioned by the DEA agent, he asked Ms. Rowe, who was a Denver police officer, if he could leave, and he was denied permission. Ms. Rowe was also asked at the motions hearing whether Mr. Lamb was free to go, and her response was, he would have a big problem if he had tried to leave before he was rebooked. So he really wasn't free to leave prior to him being rebooked and giving his boarding pass. Officer Rowe is the one who admitted to that.
But did he ask to be rebooked, or did she say, I will rebook you, don't leave?
He repeatedly asked to go because he was afraid he was going to miss his flight, and he was repeatedly denied permission to leave.
And that's then, in the record?
Yes, and all of those sites are in there on, you know, pages 40 through 45 of my brief in the footnotes. So it's Mr. Lamb's position that in this case, based on these facts and based on the federal precedent, that a search warrant was needed to search his bag after he was initially screened, cash only was found, and there was no reason to detain him based on airport security at that point, based on the admissions of all these law enforcement officers that he was posing no security threat just because he was carrying cash. And I agree that the DEA has an interest in, you know, questioning people who might be drug couriers, but that doesn't mean that they get to. Just because law enforcement would like to detain somebody and question them doesn't mean that they get to absent their consent, and that was the condition here. Mr. Lamb asked to leave, and instead he was told he had to stay until the DEA agent got there. And then, after the DEA agent got there, he was further detained while other things happened, like his bag was searched some more. He was constantly questioned throughout this entire process. And Officer Rowe from the Denver Police even admitted that her purpose in doing that was to try to match him up with a particular crime. And her intention in detaining him was to keep him long enough until she could match him up with a particular crime. And then by the time he was allowed to go to the boarding area, he was kind of a captive prisoner. They knew exactly where to go get them. And as soon as they found out about a potential home invasion in Jefferson County, that's exactly what happened. You know, I'm down to my last 5 minutes. If the court has no further direct questions of me, I would like to reserve that for rebuttal.
That's fine. And be sure to speak up into the microphone.
Okay. Try to get it as close to the mic. Can you hear me? May it please the court, my name is Emmy Langley, registration number 39075. and I represent the people in this matter. This case involves a horrific home invasion orchestrated by the defendant and five other men, during which some of the men duct taped the arms of the family members inside the home, and the defendant threatened to cut off the hand of a girl who was already disabled in order to obtain the family's life savings. And just, I'll touch on the first issue just because the appellant did. In the record, the shackling referenced by the clerk that the shackles were visible is on page 46. So that's before the trial even began. And after that, the trial court made further adjustments so the jury wouldn't see the shackles. On page 47, after the statement by the clerk, the court says, "You know what we can do? I have a better idea. Mr. Kramer, why don't you gather these people, take them through the back, and bring them in through the back for now." So the trial court made an adjustment based on what the clerk said, and that was before the trial even started. And then subsequent to that, I believe the trial court made some findings that it couldn't hear or see the shackles. And so,
now, did the trial court make any kind of a finding as to the specific need in the first place for shackles for the defendants?
In this way, this case is stronger than the co-defendants because there were some statements. The statements of what exactly the defendant said were not put on the record, but there were some statements that the defendant's attorney conceded that were made that raised some security issue that were made by the defendant.
And what were those?
Well, what the substance of the statements were was not put on the record, so we don't know that, but based on those statements, using its discretion, talking to the sheriffs, the trial court decided that the shackles were necessary. But also, the main point here is that since they weren't visible, there was no prejudice to the defendant. So therefore, the trial court did not abuse its discretion.
After these adjustments were made, did the defense counsel object to the shackles?
I'm not exactly sure. I do know that. I don't recall exactly, but after every time that, I do recall that after every objection that was made, the trial court did make a finding that was said that the trial court could not see the shackles and that they weren't visible, and which, okay. I'm going to focus my discussion on the first issue. The trial court's order denying the defendant's motion to suppress can be affirmed on three separate grounds. Number one, the defendant's encounter in the airport security area was consensual. Two, even assuming the defendant was detained, his detention was supported by reasonable suspicion. Three, even assuming that the encounter was not consensual and his detention was illegal, the consent for the search of his bag was attenuated from the detention. And I would just, furthermore, I'd like to note that even assuming the trial court erred, this court can find that the error was harmless.
Let me ask you this. Your counterpart says that we're talking about a 90-minute delay because the identification was not given back to Defendant Lamb, who, as you know, was sentenced to 160 years in prison. So, serious implications for him and for this issue. Was it 90 minutes? Was that the delay?
Two things. I do not think it was 90 minutes. I think the detention, if anything, happened when he was in the sanctioned off area. And at that point, she asked him if he would like to, or he asked if he could move into the general seating area, and she said okay. And at that point, I think that the detention ended. But I think it for sure ended at the point where she said, "Would you like to be rebooked?" And he said yes. So he expressed a desire to stay.
Did he receive his identification back at 11:30?
That I think the record is absent of when he received the identification back. All you know is in the beginning of the encounter, from what I can tell on page 108 of the March 8th hearing, and this is what the defendant cites for the proposition that the identification was never given back. At the bottom it says, you know, when he was still in the selectee area, when I saw the cash and asked him about it, I also asked, and then she says, well, they had the ID. TSA already collected his ID because that's part of what they need to do their process. But that's right when he's in the selectee area, and so we don't know whether TSA just, you know, looked at his ID just very quickly when they were, you know, originally searching his bag under the implied consent doctrine and the administrative search exception, and then gave it back. And I think it's the defendant's burden to show a seizure, so the defendant never made a showing that the ID was never given back. And also, what the record does support is that he did have two forms of valid ID. So he did have another form of valid ID the entire time.
When he was moved to the general seating area, as you described it, was he then free to go to his plane?
Well, I think when he was moved to the general seating area, he didn't ask to go to his plane until 11:30, at which time his boarding pass was no longer valid.
I don't understand that.
How do you know that? Yeah. Is there anything in the record that indicates that the plane was on time, or as we all know, planes frequently are delayed. Was there anything in the record that showing anybody attempted to find out if the plane was on time?
I don't think so. I think that we just know.
So we don't know whether the
testify that his plane was scheduled to take off and he didn't ask until 11:30. So at that point, she said, "Your boarding pass is no longer valid," and he said,
Is there some regulation or law that says it's no longer valid 5 minutes before departure?
I'm not sure about that, but I do think planes board usually way more than 5 minutes in advance of their departure. So she probably knew the protocol that it was his boarding pass, especially considering like Denver's a large airport and it would take a long time to get to his gate.
But we don't know if the plane didn't leave for another hour, do we?
I guess that's true. We don't know that. But I would think that if they were rebooking him and the plane hadn't left yet, they wouldn't rebook him. They rebooked him onto the next flight. So if the plane was delayed for a long time, technically his original flight would have been the next flight. So I don't.
Is there anything in the record to explain why it took 45 minutes to rebook him?
I don't know why, and I don't know the procedures that United Airlines would have to follow to rebook him. But I mean, just from personal experience, sometimes things at airports take a while.
Keep your voice up so everybody can hear you.
My personal experience that sometimes at airports things take a while. So.
Okay.
So I'd like to just point out that this court can find that the defendant's encounter in the airport security area was consensual. As the trial court found, signs were apparent throughout the airport indicating his bag could be searched. Jennifer Oh testified that when she asked the defendant to sit in the screen off area, she told him, "This is where I would like to have him sit, would like him to have a seat," and he said that was okay, so he answered. So I placed him there, and then the first time he asked me to be moved, I moved him back into the main traffic area. And then when he asked if he wished to rebook his flight, he answered affirmatively, indicating he wished to proceed with the process, and he even asked that his travel companion Slater be rebooked too. And I also think in the record there's evidence that he even asked somebody to use their cell phone to, you know, showing that he's just in a relaxed environment. And so I think and then when Agent Lee came and he asked if he could search his bag, he explicitly consented and he told me he was willing to talk to him.
Was he under detention when he spoke with Agent Lee?
I do not think so. At that point,
but in your brief, you state that after giving defendant the receipt for the seized, by this point the bag was seized, Lee recalled that for the first time defendant asked if he was allowed to leave, and Lee told him, "Yes, you are," and released Lamb. What was Lamb released from if it wasn't detention?
Well, I think maybe there is talking more about, in the Ortega case that we had to read for today, there's a case in the footnotes, Florida v. Bostic. And it talks about how, you know, just as a natural consequence of his desire to proceed forth with travel, you know, everybody in TSA is kind of confined in a way. Or it's talking in relation to like a bus. But just because at that point he was given his rebooked ticket, and that's probably what, you know, maybe it was referring to, that at that point, since he was given the ticket, he had a valid ticket, and then he was able to go forward.
Counsel, let me shift gears for just a moment. So I assume that it's your position that a Terry/place detention was proper, in which case you would still need to show reasonable suspicion. And what is the reasonable suspicion in this case?
Well, I think the fact that he was found with more than $20,000 in cash in his bag, coupled with the fact that Denver is a gateway city for drug trafficking. And then also the money was wrapped in rubber bands, which kind of shows it was could have been hastily gathered and was in small enough denominations requiring that the rubber bands hold it together. And he was at the gate shortly before his flight was scheduled to depart, indicating that maybe flying was a last minute decision, he wasn't quite ready to fly yet, or it could have been evidence of flight. And also, Agent Rowe, when she asked him where the money came from, he told her it was to collect a gambling debt, which in itself is a little suspicious because we don't have gambling in Colorado. So I think all those things taken together constitute reasonable suspicion.
Okay. Counsel, assuming, and I know you don't agree, but if we were to assume that the detention from 11 o'clock to 12:30, that the time period from 11 o'clock to 12:30 constituted a detention, which would be 90 minutes, would that be excessive for purposes of Terry and place?
I don't think so. I mean, you have to consider this case in its individual circumstance, in that he didn't show up to his flight until 30 minutes before it was supposed to take off. And also,
well, that's not quite right, is it? I mean, Officer Rowe wasn't called until 11 o'clock. His flight was at 11:35. Before Officer Rowe was called, he had submitted to a search to the point where they had discovered the money. So he apparently presented himself to airport security at least 40 minutes before his flight.
Maybe. I think that she testified it only takes a few minutes. So even 40 minutes before the flight, I think knowing like that they tell you to show up 2 hours before your flight takes off, and just knowing that things in airports just take longer these days post 9/11, I mean, it does seem like it was a last minute decision to take the flight, or at least he didn't show up, you know, well.
So the next time I'm late, I arrive at the airport 40 minutes before, I should assume that I'm subject to being detained?
No, but I think that, you know, perfectly legal things taken together can constitute reasons for suspicion. And also, I think, you know, 90 minutes under these circumstances is reasonable. I mean, as the trial court found, like, Agent Lee drove 100 miles per hour to get to the airport, and during this time, they were trying to help him get onto the next flight. They were rebooking him. The rebooking process took 45 minutes to an hour. So I do think that they were diligently trying to help him and move the process along.
There's an interesting
thing. Say that they ascertained that his ticket was only bought shortly before the flight? I may not have heard you correctly because of the sound system. Did you say that?
No, I don't know exactly when the ticket was bought. I think the testimony says that the credit card that was used to buy the ticket of the defendant and his companion, but I'm not exactly sure. Wait. I'm not sure what the record
is. You didn't say the ticket was hastily bought shortly before the flight.
No, I said that the money in the rubber bands show that maybe it was hastily gathered.
The 90 minutes, if that ends up being the time period, that's at least potentially significant given that that was the time period in the Supreme Court's place decision in which they found that it was unreasonable. Do you have case law since place where they have found 90 minutes or more is reasonable?
I do not, but I think place is a lot different than this case, because in place, the suitcase was seized. And also in place, I don't think the suitcase was seized until after he landed. So here he's going through the security line. His bag is kept with him the whole time. And I guess that goes towards whether he was being detained or not, but I do think place is a different kind of case because it has to do with the seizure of his luggage more than here where we're dealing with the detention of the person.
Is there indication in the record that the defendant was told that the DEA had been called and they were coming to the airport to interview him?
I don't know if he was told that or not.
And I still don't understand. Once he was put back in the general area, what's to stop him from just getting up and going down that escalator and getting on the train at DEA like we all do?
I don't know, and that goes to whether he felt free to leave, and I think that it's perfectly reasonable to find that he did feel free to leave, and that's why my argument is that the whole encounter was consensual. I'd like to point out that even assuming the defendant was legally detained, this court can still find that the consent to search his bag was sufficiently attenuated from the detention. Attenuation provides that even if there is an illegal detention, the subsequent consent is not tainted by the prior detention. So if the detention occurred when he was in the sanctioned off area, after that occurred, he asked to be put in a general seating area and was accommodated. Then he expressed a desire to stay and be rebooked. And then he consented to the search and even consented to talk to Agent Lee. Therefore, I think that the defendant, even if he was illegal detained for a portion of the time, that illegal detainment wasn't, his subsequent consent was not tainted by that illegal detention. And then finally, I just want to point out that even assuming that the trial court erred in denying the defendant's motion to suppress the search of his bag, any error was harmless. I think the best evidence at trial, given that the defendant's defense at trial was that he wasn't there, the best evidence tying him to the crime was the victim's identifying him. And what happened at the airport, what was uncovered there, was jewelry and masks that had linked him to the crime, but there was other corroborating evidence also that was part of the trial too, which, such as the co-defendant Fong identifying him at trial, and also the defendant on his way to a few days before the home invasion occurred, he was pulled over with Fong, and you know, a police officer was able to identify the defendant as traveling with Fong. So I do think that there's corroborating evidence other than the evidence that was obtained, the fruits of the search by Lee, by Agent Lee. So.
Well, if he hadn't been arrested at the airport, they wouldn't have had a photo lineup with the defendants with his picture in it, would they?
Well, I think that the case law says that you can't suppress the person. So even if the fruits of the search is suppressed, he still couldn't suppress himself. So the identification still would have.
Does Ortega have anything to do with this case?
Excuse me?
Does the Ortega decision have any bearing on this case?
Oh, I think Ortega is a little bit different because Ortega had to do with the seizure of property. And and the reasonable suspicion to support the seizure of property. Here we have the original search being legal under the implied consent doctrine. So there's no reasonable suspicion to do the original search. And also the property, unlike in Ortega, in this case was never seized. So it's a little bit different, I think.
Okay, counsel, thank you. And rebuttal, you have 5 minutes left, Ms. Ruttenberg.
First of all, I need to clear up some misrepresentations that were made regarding the record regarding the shackling. The Attorney General.
Be sure to speak up.
The Attorney General is correct that the clerk made the remark about the shackles being visible during pretrial procedures. However, the implication that the jury wasn't there is absolutely false. Those pretrial procedures were jury selection itself. Therefore, they were made the day of jury selection. They were made after that day's proceedings were over. So all of the jury members were sitting there in the courtroom during that entire time when the clerk said that the shackles were visible and audible. And then the Attorney General said, well, this case is even stronger than the co-defendant because of the remark that the court made that something happened at the jail with regard to my client. This is what the court said, volume 10, page 7, lines 3 to 8. There's something in the, and I don't know anything, the only thing I know, Ms. Sanders, is there's something in the comments in the jail, you know, the jail comments concerning your client about statements that he may have made. I don't have access to those. So now Ms. Sanders was not my client's trial counsel. Ms. Sanders was the co-defendant's trial counsel. The judge was referring to the co-defendant, not Ms. Lamb. Therefore, there was zero evidence in the record of any justification whatsoever to shackle my client. The court never exercised her discretion at all to make any findings of fact or conclusions of law that there was any justification to shackle my client. All she did was just rely on what the sheriffs wanted her to do, and she admitted as much. All she had to go on was somebody at the jail, somebody she doesn't even know, that she has no access to and didn't even order produced, made some stray remark about the co-defendant that then through third degree hearsay, through a sheriff's deputy and then back to her, was the only record made regarding any justification for shackling. So again, I would ask the court to consider the shackling issue on the merits.
People say defendant's counsel indicated it was defendant who made the statements arousing security. April 3rd, 06 transcript, page 7. Are you saying that is not this defendant?
It is the court's remarks and what she's relying on. She's addressing Ms. Sanders. There was never any record made as to what, if anything, was ever made at the jail. I see the problem is that, my client's trial counsel, who's now unfortunately died of cancer, so we can't even, examine her at a Rule 35C proceeding. She was trying to make a record and was cut off that whatever comments were made had nothing to do with security to begin with, and that there was no comments made at the jail regarding my client.
All right, so if I look at the record that's referred to by the people here, when it says defendant's counsel, it won't be Mr. Lamb's counsel, it'll be Ms. Sanders, the counsel for the other defendant. That's what you're saying, right?
That's what the court relied on.
Second question. When the clerk of the court made the comment about the shackles, I thought you were saying it was made in the presence of the jury. That's not what you're saying. You're saying the jury had been there that day.
No, the jury,
the remark was made.
The jury had left, had already left that day, but the clerk was referring to the visibility of the shackles during the proceeding that day, which was jury selection.
Thank you.
Now, quickly going back to the issue of consent, where, it keeps coming up, well, why didn't he just get up and walk away? Well, in my section of the brief dealing with consent, we quoted what Officer Rowe said. She said, even though she never told him he was free to leave, she testified that he would have had a problem if he had tried to turn around and go back through the magnometers. That indicates that if he had gotten up and tried to leave,
okay,
she would have arrested
him.
Everybody
knows that. That's obvious. We know that from being here. Why couldn't he have just gone down the steps and gotten on the train?
Because she told him he had to stay. She told him he had to stay in this cordoned-off area. He was never told he was free to leave. He asked to leave, and she kept directing him to stay seated until his flight was rebooked. She never gave him the option of turning around and going back into the terminal and rebooking his own flight. She kept him there for 45 minutes while they rebooked his flight, never giving him an option to do anything else. And then again, quickly, if I can get there. Agent Lee requested permission from Mr. Lamb to search his person and his personal belongings, but by the time that it happened, he had already been detained at the screening area for approximately an hour, and he was still waiting on a new boarding pass to be issued, which provided his sole means of exiting the screening area and proceeding towards the gate because he was told he would not be allowed to leave without a valid boarding pass. And anybody who's been to DIA knows that. You have to present a valid boarding pass to get out of there, to get on the train, to go to the terminal.
All right, counsel, your time's up.
I'm out of time.
Thank you both for very good arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.